from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Technology is pushing the limits of what the human body can do thanks to computer programs that help blind people see and surgeries that merge people with metal limbs.
They have this experimental new surgery, and they amputate in such a way that they keep some of the muscles exposed so that they can better merge with the machine and that this person can then move the prosthetic just by thinking.
That's Adam Piori, author of the new book, The Bodybuilders, Inside the Science of the Engineered Human, and he'll join us to talk about the latest scientific strides and the ethical questions they raise, coming up after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Well, if you're wondering what that sound is, we're not playing video games or communicating with Mars over here. That is the sound of a computer program that uses certain noises to create audio images for blind people and essentially help them to, quote, see. And that's one of the many engineering technologies that Adam Piori learned about while researching his new book, The Bodybuilders, Inside the Science of the Engineered Human. He looks at different ways we can bioengineer our bodies to augment and enhance them and some of the ethical challenges that come along with it. And he joins us in studio for this hour. And welcome, Adam Piori.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. This is a brave new world of bioengineering. You cover a lot of it, also biomedical research. A lot of it certainly sounds like science fiction, but it's often science fiction. I remember somebody pointing out to me years ago that Jules Verne, all the things that he wrote about in science fiction have come to pass and came to pass in no time at all. So that's a lot of your territory here. Let's talk about, though, making blind people see. I mean, what we just heard. Flesh this out for us, can you?
Yeah, well, I used it as one of the more remarkable examples of how bioengineers are using neuroplasticity, which is, you know, recently discovered capability of our brains to rewire themselves. A lot of the topics that I covered in the book had to do with unleashing latent human resilience. And I was trying to demonstrate the impact that these technologies were actually having on people's life right now. So I met a woman named Pat Fletcher, and she had this device. She was blinded in an industrial accident. She was working in a grenade factory, and there was an explosion. She lost both her eyeballs, and she couldn't see. And many years later, she was surfing on the web, and she came across this program that converts – what it does is it converts the pixels in images into tones. And it turns out our brains are capable of processing a wide array of tones simultaneously, like, you know, maybe 30 tones or something. So you just get this wall of sound, and the higher up the pixel is in the picture, the higher the tone, and volume has to do with how dark it is. And over time, Pat Fletcher's brain rewired, and it learned to actually interpret these, what she calls soundscapes, and route them to her visual cortex, and she can actually see again.
So. Which is pretty extraordinary and exciting. I mean, actually being able to see with your ears.
Yeah, I mean, the resolution is not obviously as good as real eyes, but she was able to see mountains again for the first time in 20 years. You know, she started crying. She saw leaves in the trees. She can see sort of people's faces, not all the features, but so it's pretty remarkable. She even regained depth perception after a while.
Our guest this hour is Adam Piori, and he's a journalist, former editor, and correspondent for Newsweek, and has a new book out called The Bodybuilders, Inside the Science of the Engineered Human. A lot of this, if I may say so, Adam, is stuff that people would recognize, or not that surprising, in terms of biotechnology and the like. You've got stuff about regrowing fingertips, things that we read about, and sometimes out of Ripley's, believe it or not, repairing leg muscles that have been blown off by explosions, these kinds of things. A lot of them having to do with military, getting people back in shape after they've gone through stepping on mines and that sort of thing. But you've also got a lot of bioengineering here, and a lot of it has to do with just building and rebuilding human bodies. And that's kind of a field that almost at this point keep extending on, don't we?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was, you know, Peter Thiel said recently that, you know, that as computational power will allow us to unlock a lot of the secrets reverse engineer biology, and that's sort of what's happening. And that's what I set out to find. You know,
you mean Peter Thiel?
Peter Thiel, sorry, I always pronounce his name wrong. Anyways, that's what he said. And that's what's happening in a lot of these technologies. That's what's allowing bioengineers to hack into the human body and mind.
Yeah, in fact, you make the point. It used to be we were always looking outward. Now we're kind of going inward in terms of our own bodies. Always science looking to experiment in the outer world and now moving more and more into the inner world, including the brain, of course, with all this neuropathology, neuropathmaking and pathfinding. Viagra for the brain?
Right. Well, that's going on outside San Diego, and that's an effort to reverse engineer the molecular basis of memory and find ways to hack into it with small molecule drugs and basically make a memorization pill. And around the turn of the millennium, there were some advances, and there were no less than three former Nobel laureates who were involved in companies, but a lot of them went bankrupt because they couldn't get a drug that was safe and the cost of developing it was so much. The one that I profiled in San Diego is bankrolled by this sort of reclusive billionaire styrofoam magnate named Kenneth Dart. He's agreed to pony up about $2 billion over 20 years to try and come up with, basically, it would be a blockbuster drug. It would help all of us have memorization.
And the other thing that seems to come into what you bring to our attention here is telepathy. I mean, you know, it was always considered a sixth sense, but suddenly it's become real.
Right. Well, I wanted to, you know, I looked at some of the things that we can do now, like the human leg is a web of springs built of tendons, ligaments, muscles, and we can sort of reverse engineer all the way those constituent parts fit together and build a robotic limb. And that, you know, that's happening now. But I wanted to go to the far edge. And, you know, to me, computationally, it seems the human brain is very, you know, we have billions of neurons and we don't yet have the computing power to and pattern recognition power to reverse engineer it and interpret the signals in real time. Decoding imagined speech seemed like the far frontier. And they're actually trying to do that. There's a guy named Gerwin Schalk. He actually collaborates with people in Berkeley. He is using a technique. He works with epilepsy patients who have the top of their skull removed and they have electrodes placed on their naked cortex. And they're just sitting there waiting to have seizures so doctors can identify, you know, map out the area of their pathology. And Gerwin goes in and he does these experiments. And what he does is he has them imagine speaking and tries to decode their brain patterns. And what he and others have discovered is that when we speak, our brain sends neural signals to the motor cortex to make the sounds, but it also sends a copy of that to the auditory cortex as an error correction mechanism, which they call an efference copy. And even when we just imagine speaking, that efference copy still goes to the auditory cortex. So he's been trying to track and decode that, and he can, better than chance, he can discern between two different sentences and stuff. But we don't have the signal processing power yet to decode, you know, all of what somebody's thinking, but they're moving in that direction.
They're in that direction or in that trajectory, and that would mean a great deal for communicating, let's say, mute patients communicating or the disabled communicating, yeah?
Right, yeah. I mean, I profiled in the book. I wanted to see what was really possible, what our limits are, and how it was affecting real people. So one of the people I profiled in that same chapter with Gerwin Schalk was a locked-in patient who, you know, he was a young guy when he got ALS. And I think his wife was pregnant. And so he was gradually losing the ability to communicate with his kids. And he used technologies that could pick up on muscle signals, but he was going to lose even the muscle signals. So this would be, you know, a lifesaver for somebody like that. But strangely, Gerwin was initially funded by somebody in the U.S. military who had read, I forget which science fiction author, but there was somebody who had, in his book, he had something called a thought helmet, which allowed people to communicate telepathically. So this guy wanted to see if it was possible to build a thought helmet. And he was in a position of power and had a PhD and was able to win funding and then convince Gerwin Schalk to begin looking at this possibility, which seemed like science fiction at the time, but now seems possible.
Well, there is, in fact, you write about some of the technology that applies to those who are unfortunately tragically afflicted with Lou Gehrig disease, with ALS. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so there are ways. I mean, you can blink and you can do other things, but to actually be able to speak you know, just have your thoughts read simultaneously so that it's the same as actually speaking is the ultimate goal, I guess, which would have all sorts of implications for humanity and the able-bodied as well. But
yeah, there are a lot of ultimate goals in your book and a lot to learn about the people involved in the work and the research, excuse me, and those who want to benefit by them. Let's talk about exoskeletons. That's a technology now for those who are wheelchair-bound. And you actually, I think about Iron Man, I guess a lot of people do, but didn't you get into one of those, walk around in one?
Yeah, I actually went in the East Bay. There's a company called Exobionics, a lot of people have probably heard of, and I tried out an exoskeleton there. It seemed like I could go to sleep in it, and it would walk me across the bridge. And, you know, that was a strange experience. I also tried what they call a muscle suit. I was in Japan, and I put on this suit that allowed me to I lifted about 100 pounds with my fingertips. It felt like a piece of paper. So I tried a number of those things. And
what was that sensation like?
It was just kind of, it was very bizarre. I mean, actually, it was a scientist, the Japanese scientist pressed a button and I picked this thing up and I thought, hey, what just happened? You know, but that would be kind of cool to be that strong all the time.
It would be cool. You feel like a superhero. I mentioned Iron Man already with the exoskeletons. Also, you write about unleashing creativity and some of the studies that take us along that trajectory.
Yeah, one of the things they found, and again, another San Francisco angle, there's a guy named Bruce Miller at UCSF who a number of years ago, he was working with patients with frontotemporal dementia, and he started noticing, he heard from I think it was the son of one of the patients, that the more his father lost his cognitive reasoning skills, the more he had developed a desire to draw and paint, and he was actually quite good. And, you know, at first Miller didn't really know what to think of it, but he saw the paintings and they were very skilled and talented. And he started looking and seeing this pattern in other patients. And what he found was, and what people are finding is that there's areas of the brain that have to do with our cognitive reasoning and verbal skills and social inhibitions. And they exert an inhibitory control over parts of our brain that are involved in idea generation and creativity. And so that was what was happening in some of these patients. But other people have begun to experiment with technologies, you know, that can sort of temporarily immobilize the parts of those parts of the brain that are holding the other parts in check. And they have shown that it does seem to unleash some creativity. And I met a guy who there's a small percentage of people who have actually gotten head injuries and caused, seems like, brain damage, and they have unlocked latent creative skills. There's a guy in Wisconsin who actually named Daryl Treffert, and he's one of the world's experts on savants and what he calls prodigious savants. He actually consulted on the movie Rain Man, and he has described this new class of people called acquired savants, who get these kind of head injuries or they get a stroke or something. There's a famous case of a guy in Britain. He was sort of a construction worker who liked to brawl and drink and sort of the last person you would expect to become I think he became a poet after he had a stroke. I don't know. And then there's a guy in Boston who was, I think,
Bukowski type poet, maybe.
Yeah. And he could just free associate all these words, you know. And there's a guy in Boston named John Sarkin, and I think he was an accountant or a chiropractor. I don't know. And then he had a stroke on the golf course or something. And suddenly, you know, now he's this, you know, his pictures have appeared in The New Yorker. So I don't know.
We're talking to Adam Peori, and his book is called The Bodybuilders: Inside the Science of the Engineered Human. A lot of these things we're talking about, I want to talk to you about Hugh Hare in a moment, but bring up some serious ethical questions.
Yeah, that's certainly true. I mean, almost all the chapters do. And that's something I tried to grapple with. But also one of the reasons I wanted to do this book is because, you know, I read a lot about the technologies in the future, you know, some of these technologies. And to me, I found that a lot of the books fell into two categories. One, they were sort of futurist and they were vaguely predicting, you know, we will be able to do this, we will be able to do that. And I didn't have any sense or I couldn't evaluate whether that was actually true because I didn't understand the science and I didn't know what was happening now. And then there's all these books that look at the ethics, and they all are also somewhat vague because they talk about, you know, there's so many different ways that these things can develop. So I wanted to look at, you know, I'm a reporter, so I wanted to go out and see what is actually possible now, what people are doing, how it's affecting people's lives, and sort of give people the background to evaluate these many ethical issues as they come up. And I tried to point them out when they did, and they came up quite often. But really, the reality is I asked a military scientist, I said, well, are these technologies a good thing or a bad thing? And he said, it depends. You know, is a baseball bat a good thing or a bad thing? It's a good thing if you're playing baseball with it. It's a bad thing if you're using it as a club to hit somebody over the head with. So that's really the case here.
You want to talk about Hugh Hare?
Sure. Yeah. Hugh Hare was one of the people who he kind of blew my mind, you know, and got me interested in this topic. I lived in Cambodia. I started my career in San Francisco writing for the Bay Guardian. I've been in Iraq. I covered 9/11. I've written and I covered Congress, left in the middle of Monica Lewinsky. And, you know, this is sort of a strange turn that I've taken over the last 10 years, but it was sort of prompted in part by Hugh Hare, because one of the things that has always fascinated me is human resilience. And I'm always looking for good stories. And Hugh Hare had a story that was just as dramatic and just as inspiring as many of the ones I came across in other areas of reporting. It just sort of drew me into this. And what it was is that he was a champion rock climber. A lot of people have heard of him, but he was one of the most well-known rock climbers on the East Coast. He was kind of seen as a prodigy. He was 16 or 17 and not particularly good at school, but all he wanted to do was climb. And then one day in the winter, he went ice climbing with a friend of his in Mount Washington, New Hampshire, and they wandered into the wilderness and got lost, and they almost died. They were rescued at the very last minute, and the
frostbite was pretty terrible.
Yeah, the frostbite was terrible, and they were medevaced out, and Hugh Hare lost both his legs below the knee, and the doctors told him he'd never run, never climb again. But he started messing with his prosthetics to get back on the climbing wall. He made them 7 feet long. He made them little bladed things so he could climb crevices, and with that he got into engineering. He started taking classes. He became a straight A student. Now he's the leading prosthetics engineer in the country, one of them at MIT, and he's made these robotic limbs that allow him to walk. I couldn't even tell he was where, you know, I couldn't tell that he was missing his lower limbs when I went to hang out with him at MIT. It's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable all you've covered here. I mean, this is the work of about 8 years of reporting, and there's a lot of good being done, a lot of inspirational kinds of things that you get here. But, you know, some people say, well, you're tweaking with the body's machinery. You don't mess with Mother Nature. You shouldn't do that sort of thing. Was this a sort of ethical concern or caveat that you heard?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, especially in some of these areas. Obviously, the most obvious area, I mean, it's hard to argue with somebody replacing a peg leg with a robotic limb that kind of replicates.
No ethical problem there. No.
That it replicates the real thing. But when you talk about genetic engineering, then you have a whole can of worms, right? So the way that I tried to handle that was the reality is that most traits in genetically determined traits are determined by a combination of many genes and environmental factors. And we don't have the capacity yet to, you know, rewrite genomes to change everything. And a lot of the challenge right now is bringing down the cost of sequencing genomes and developing the processing power to compare, billions of nucleotides across many genomes. But there are certain traits that we can tweak, that certain rare mutations that rare conditions that are caused by one stray mutation. So I looked at, in my book, I looked at, I profiled a guy named Lee Sweeney who he wanted to help patients who had Duchenne's muscular dystrophy, you know, and they basically are missing a protein that serves as a cellular shock absorber, and their muscles basically rip themselves apart. And so he found a way to tweak this protein called myostatin, which is a negative regulator on muscle growth. And if you knock it out, then your muscles get bigger. And he figured he would buy these Duchenne's muscular dystrophy patients a little time, also help age-related muscle wasting. And he made these mice that the press dubbed Schwarzenegger mice. And it caused a sensation. They were these totally ripped mice with artificially ballooned muscles. And you can imagine the press that generated. You might have heard of it. But, you know, and then the next day, his office was besieged with calls from some Duchenne's muscular dystrophy patient parents, but also from a bunch of meatheads from around the country who wanted him to make them, you know, Schwarzenegger men. And one high school football coach even wanted Sweeney to gene dope his entire team. So what's happened is Sweeney has, you know, he's had to deal with these ethical issues straight up on the front lines. And what he's done is he's continued to work on tweaking muscles. And he has made Labrador Retriever Schwarzenegger dogs, you know, but then very quietly.
Happens to be my favorite breed.
Yeah. But at the same time, he serves as a consultant on the World Anti-Doping Authority, trying to come up with tests so that to test athletes against gene doping. But, you know, like the guy said with the baseball bat, it depends. Everything we can do to help somebody can also be used to enhance somebody. And that's one of the challenges here. And I'm not sure what the solution is.
My first Labrador was much too big. The head was too big and everything else. I don't know if it was a genetic problem or certainly had nothing to do with tweaking or bioengineering, which is really what we're talking about here among the whole sense of a brave new world. And let me open the phone lines and hear from you, our listeners. I know there are many of you with questions and certainly thoughts and comments and reflecting about what Adam Peori has explored here. As I said, it's going on about 8 years now. Many really extraordinary things being done. It is a brave new world, as Huxley said, and you may want to weigh in here about the ethics or just simply let us know your thoughts. We welcome them and we welcome your calls. Our toll-free number is available and you can reach us now by calling us at 866-733-6786. Love to hear from you, and I know many of you have some thoughts and have some things you'd like to express on this whole topic that we're looking at. And by the way, it not only includes bioengineering, regenerative medicine, brain-computer interfacing, all of those sorts of things. Lots being done with body machinery, but also with the mind as well. And Adam covers the territory here. He's former editor and correspondent for Newsweek. And again, we welcome your involvement in the program. You can join us toll-free at 866-733-6786. A number of other ways you can join us. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And Facebook, somebody sent us Direct Brain Interface, a creation of its secretive building, a division exploring silent speech system with a team of more than 60 scientists that would essentially make it possible for people to type 100 words per minute with their brain. You know, right, about this, Adam?
Yeah, I've heard about it. I don't know that much about it. I mean, I've been thinking about that. And also Elon Musk has, you know, announced that he is trying to come up with something called neural lace, right? And so I don't know the exact approach that Facebook is taking. There already have been some brain-computer interfaces. They've demonstrated in a lab that you can actually tap into the human motor cortex and have somebody drink, you know, move a woman who's locked in or paralyzed below the neck. She can move a bionic arm just by thinking and drink, I think, chocolate milk, right? So you can imagine that Facebook pretty soon could come up with some way to allow you to type just by thinking. Or there's a much cruder signal that's a global brain signal called the P300 response, and that is when you see a letter that you're looking at.
We're coming up on a break here. Hold that thought. We'll come back to it, and we'll go to our callers. You're on the line. Hang on. You can join us. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. There is lots going on out there in the world of, bioengineering and a brave new world. And Adam Peori has explored much of it in his new book, Bodybuilders, Inside the Science of the Engineered Human. We're talking about giving people the ability to see thermal images through walls, build Iron Man-like exoskeletons, unleash and untapped stores of creativity. We covered a lot of that. Also, photographic memory pills. And the military is trying to reverse engineering human intuition so they could train soldiers to just sense when something is wrong. And some of this stuff is pretty extraordinary, to put it mildly. And the trajectories are already there. The questions have to do often with the ethical possible consequences ethically that one has to face. We're going to go to your calls and emails. And again, you can join us by email, forum@kqed.org, or by going to our website, kqed.org/forum. And you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Or you can also post comments or questions on our Facebook page. And we were just talking with Adam Peori about Facebook when we went to the break there. You had a thought to finish?
I was just saying, you know, I don't know the details of what Facebook is doing in their secretive building, but there's a number of crude signals that you can already pick up by scanning the brain that could be used to type just by thinking. If in terms of actually decoding imagined speech, I don't think we're there yet. And it's hard to see them developing that, I don't know, in the next couple of years. But that is the area, the direction that we're headed in.
Well, between Facebook and Google, there are brave new universes, not even brave new worlds. I mean, you know, Google has this project of extending lifespan indefinitely and so forth. Ray Kurzweil is involved, and
right.
So are many leading scientists. But let's get our listeners involved. Let's begin, Bruce, with you. You're on the air. Good morning.
Thank you. Great program, long listener. My question has to do with stem cell treatment. Especially with, in order to avoid hip replacement, which is a horrible surgery. And I know it is being practiced in Europe and in Israel, and I know in this country they are using part of this stem cell for knee replacement. Any news about that? Any information? I'd be grateful.
I'm not sure what is approved. I know that one of the people that I profiled in the book, a guy named Steve Badalak, has been working with a material that that recruits stem cells. Basically, it's a scaffolding, and he tried. You put it in an area where that needs to be regenerated. The body begins to break it down. It releases signaling agents that summon stem cells to the area, and he was trying to get it approved for some knee problems, and it didn't work because he couldn't. It worked in dogs, but it didn't really work in humans because he couldn't get people to stay still long enough. I don't know what the situation is with the stem cells in Europe and Israel. I'd be cautious, but it's definitely worth exploring.
Well, Bruce, thank you for the call. We may hear from somebody else who can give information on that. A lot of scientists listen to the program and people who are involved in stem cell research. I thank you for the call and remind you that we're talking to Adam Peore, who is a journalist and former editor and correspondent for Newsweek and author of The Bodybuilders. Let's go to a caller in Mobile, Alabama. Tom, you're on the air.
Well, hello. Good morning.
Morning.
I have a question. I just recently read that, let me preface my question. I'm a high-level quadriplegic with a spinal cord injury, and I follow these things. I have a lot of hope in science. And in Iran, they just mandated genome testing to hopefully eliminate gene disorders in their population. When will the ability in the future, the expense of genome testing and the science advanced to a point to where it's like the zebrafish's ability to repair spinal cord injury naturally and certain salamanders that can regrow limbs? When will these therapies be applicable to a mature mammalian organism?
Well, thank you for the question, Tom. Adam, any insight you can provide?
Yeah, I've looked at some of these issues. I mean, you know, they're talking about doing a – this has gotten some press. They're doing a full body transplant.
It did in Cleveland, in fact, yeah.
Really?
I think, yeah.
It doesn't – I mean, I don't see how the nerves can regenerate to connect at this point. It seems really risky, but it's definitely on the horizon. People are – I mean, to me, when I began reporting this book, it seemed totally ludicrous that someday we'd be able to regrow human limbs. But there are people looking at that, and some of the scientists are serious scientists. There's a guy that I talked to at Tufts named Michael Levin. And, you know, I said, don't you face skepticism? And he said, well, I can see that if you said that it's possible to breathe on Mars without air, you could say that's crazy. But I don't see how you can say regrowing limbs is crazy because salamanders do it. And what they've done is they're trying to actually reverse engineer and figure out what processes are in place that are allowing salamanders to regrow limbs. And they've actually made some progress. This guy, Michael Levin, has caused an adolescent frog to grow 5 or 6 legs. And he's done so in part by manipulating these minute electrical currents on the outside of cells, which seem to have certain signaling properties within them. One of the problems, though, in doing it in war, and the main challenge they're dealing with now is, and they're trying to do this in a mouse, is warm-blooded creatures, you know, will bleed out. So you need to create some sort of device, which they've been working on, to prevent that from happening.
Actually, what they did in Cleveland was a face transplant, not a body transplant.
Oh,
but,
right.
You know, I mean, it was major, innovative and remarkable procedure.
Yeah.
Listener named Wendy wants to know, when are we going to be able to record our dreams? That's what I'd like to see, she says.
Record our dreams. Well, the same, you know, there's a couple teams in Berkeley that are looking at using brain imaging technologies. And, you know, I don't know. There's a guy, the Night Lab, right? I don't know if you've ever had him on, but he's been looking at decoding images in people's brains. He can tell, he shows people movies and he can kind of see what they look like. I don't know how close he is to actually being able to do that in real time and decode dreams, but it's pretty remarkable that they can actually read people's minds. I think the best tactic now is still to practice waking up and writing them down, and then you get better remembering them. It's going to be a while till we can have a computer.
Remember the name of the movie with Leonardo DiCaprio where they go into the dream?
Oh, yeah, Inception.
Inception, right.
Yeah. It's going to be a while.
Let me get some more callers on her. Dan is joining us. Dan, you're on.
Yes, hello. Thanks for taking my call. So what, our species has been on this planet for 200,000 years, a hominid line, a bit longer than that. My question is, do you think we're going to have human beings in 500 years and 1,000 years, considering the rate of progress that we can manipulate our genes?
No. Just kidding. I don't know. I mean,
we've got climate change to contend with, among other things.
Right, and nuclear bombs. I mean, a lot of people ask me if I'm alarmed by these technologies. And what I found, actually, when I went out and looked at them was that the way they were being used now, I mean, like I said, I picked up 100 pounds with my fingertips. I tried an exoskeleton. I had electricity zapped through my brain. And that was all pretty cool. But the things that really blew my mind, the things that were really having an impact, were where people lost ability to do things and regained them using these technologies, like Pat Fletcher, who could look at mountains, and Hugh Herr, who is able to go jogging every day on prosthetic limbs when people told him he could never run. So, that is what got my attention. And when people ask me if I'm alarmed or worried about 500 years or 1,000 years, I just say, well, we already have the ability to vaporize each other with nuclear bombs. This is just another tool in the arsenal, another way that we could destroy each other or things could go awry. So in terms of evolution and Homo Deus and all of that, you know, we might evolve. I guess Elon Musk, one of the things that he's talked about with the neural lace is he's very concerned about artificial intelligence sort of turning us into pet food or something, right? So if we can merge and have access to the same sort of computational power and merge with computers, then we can counteract things and protect the species. So I guess it depends on whoever classifies what is a human being.
Well, if we keep moving forward with artificial intelligence, though, something, you know, maybe time for the robots to take over as time progresses. But you talk about electricity zapping your brain. You know, at one time, shock treatments were considered absolutely verboten, particularly in wake of like Ken Kesey's One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Sylvia Plath, you know, who went through some shock treatments that were terrible. But the fact is they're being used more now in a limited way with schizophrenia, with mental illnesses, and with some success, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, they have people seem to be cautiously experimenting with them. And in my book, I talked about, you know, there's this technique called deep brain stimulation, which is being used to, it's already being used to still the tremors in Parkinson's disease and to help obsessive compulsive disorder. And this would be a step beyond shock treatment. What they're trying to do is they're trying to, and DARPA, you know, the Pentagon's Blue Sky Research Organization, which is handling a lot of the money from Obama's Brain Initiative, has been funding development of the next generation of DBS, which wouldn't just apply shocks to sort of break up aberrant brain patterns, but would also track signals in certain parts of the brain. And, you know, if somebody's having a panic attack, maybe it could have algorithms that could detect that and then shock it back into the way it's supposed to be. And this could have, you know, part of this, the program's stated purpose is to work with a lot of psychiatric disorders like schizophrenia or borderline personality disorder. But this, you know, and I noted this in my book. I mean, this fell out of favor along with shock therapy in the 60s and 70s. They were using basically not electroconvulsive therapy, but something where they had electrodes in the brain and they would just zap people. And they were doing experiments on mental patients. And there was this famous neuroscientist named Delgado at Yale, and I think he actually was able, he implanted an electrode in a bull, and then the bull charged him, and he pressed a button, and the bull stopped charging him, and that was his famous experiment. And they were, there was all sorts of hope that this could be used for all sorts of things to help people with various problems, but eventually people started experimenting. One guy down in Tulane, he got a gay man and implanted electrodes in his the pleasure centers of his brain and hired a female prostitute. And then there was two collaborators of Delgado, I think at Harvard, who published a book saying lobotomies and this kind of brain stimulation could be used to control rioting people in the inner cities. And it rapidly fell out of favor. There were Senate hearings. It's a perfect illustration of the ethical problems. And nobody could get funding for many years. Now, cautiously, because there's so much hope and we know so much more about the brain, people are tiptoeing into that area again.
They're also tiptoeing into psychedelics and MDMA and, you know, all kinds of things which do have effect on the brain, have had effect on the brain and continue to. But, I mean, looking at those sorts of things as possibilities of actually providing some help. And let me go to more of our callers. Let's bring in some more calls here. Let me go next to Alex. You're on. Morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I have two things going on. The first one is that I was born with my full vision, and somewhere along the line when I was a baby, I had an infection, and my mom was a teenager, so she didn't know what to do, and by the time she took me to the hospital, I lost the vision in my left eye. And so I was wondering if there's anything going to help us in that direction. People that were born okay, but then somehow lost the vision due to infection. And the second part is most recently I've had floaters in my right eye, and I've been told by my doctors that there's not much they can do to get rid of them, and they're mostly in my in the part of my vision.
Well, Alex, thank you for the call. Let me go to Adam on this. Adam Perry, what do we know about the advancements along these lines with vision impairment?
It depends. I mean, there's so many different ways you can lose vision and so many different conditions. But I know that, you know, one of the probably the gene therapy that a lot of people think will be the first to be approved by the FDA in the U.S. will fix a congenital form of blindness. It's a company called Spark Therapeutics. But that sounds like a different case than this one.
Yeah, it does.
What they found, like the woman Pat Fletcher, they found that, basically we see with the brain, not with the eyes. And if you can get the information into the brain, it can be routed to the visual cortex and you can regain some sight. The level of resolution is not as good as a regular eye at this point, right? So, like I said, Pat Fletcher can't see all the details in regular faces. But it's a lot. I mean, the best example to look at is, and people are trying to come up with, I don't know what's wrong. I couldn't figure out exactly what's wrong with his eyes, you know, but so I don't know. They're trying to fix the hardware, I guess you could say, of the eye itself. They're trying to come up with replacements from that, but they're also trying to come up with ways to get the signals into the brain. So the best example, most successful example in hearing is the cochlear implant, right? Which does not precisely replicate at the same resolution the sounds and the way that the cochlea is shocked when real sounds enter the ear. But it does so, it sends signals in a consistent manner so the brain learns to recognize them. And the same can be said for eye and vision and sensory substitution devices. And people are working on those.
Good luck to you, Alex, and thank you for the call. Here's Austin, who wants to know, where are we in starting to understand the millions of terabytes of storage capacity within the brain and how that relates to memory?
I'm not sure. Let me think about that for a sec. I mean, our long-term memory is potentially unlimited, right? That's what we haven't found a limit on it yet. The bottleneck has to do with short-term memory and working memory, and people are trying to figure out. And people have suggested various reasons why that might be limited, the most commonly accepted idea is that memories are encoded in the connections between individual neurons in the brain, and this guy that I was talking to in San Diego at Dart Pharmaceuticals is trying to come up with pills that would just make it much easier to form these connections if you take a pill, a memorization pill. And one of the things that he's doing is they're scouring the world for people with superior memory, and they're trying to find people. They're trying to get a large enough sample that they can then take the DNA and find out what mutations allow them to take advantage of those gazillion terabytes of capacity and instantly make memories. I mean, we can make memories of most things if we repeat it enough. The trick is having an instant memory without repetition.
More of your calls. Gary, joining us next. Gary, thanks for waiting.
Yes, I had DBS in January 2015. And, you know, it's brain surgery, and they keep you partially awake, and they see which areas your brain react. I didn't have much dyskinesia, but it seemed to really help any kind of dyskinesia I had. But I still lock in place with that surgery, and I was a little disappointed. But other people who see me say I'm much better. I don't have all the shakes and everything that I used to have. So, the positive outcome seems to be if you have a lot of dyskinesia in your arms or legs, that it really does help. But the still locking in place on the symptoms of Parkinson's, it still needs some work.
Thank you, Gary. Good luck to you. Appreciate hearing from you, and we'll hear from some more of our callers and go right next to Michael. Morning.
Hi.
Hi.
I was hoping you're going to touch on, and I'm now going to introduce rejuvenation biotechnology, the new cellular molecular medicines that are being worked on by Sen's Research Foundation and a lot of cutting-edge groups here in California and elsewhere around the world, where we're identifying new methods to remove and repair the cellular molecular damage that accumulates in aging cells and tissues and causes us to slowly lose our health as we age and develop the diseases and disabilities of aging and eventually, shrivel up and die. There's a real possibility we're going to be able to remove that cellular damage and keep people young and healthy for decades longer and possibly eventually indefinitely.
At a Peori?
I've written about that too. I mean, there's a lot of exciting things going on. I was trying to remember whether there's a really interesting company that came out of the Buck Institute with Judy Campisi. I think it's called Unity Biotechnologies. I don't know. Jeff Bezos invested in it, Ark Venture Capital, and they're using something called, I'm going to mispronounce the word, right? But we have these cells that become basically senescent, and they cause inflammation. As we get old, they don't die, but they don't do anything except draw inflammatory molecules and cause problems. And they're developing drugs that are going to clear these out, which I think is one of the most exciting and promising treatments for age-related diseases and decline.
What else in your research did you find particularly exciting? I mean, to the point where, you were reacting with excitement, actually.
Well, it was pretty crazy when I was writing again about the efforts to decode imagined speech. This guy, Gerwin Schalk, he took me into his lab and he played me a song, and it was Pink Floyd's Another Brick in the Wall, and it sounded a little like it was underwater, being played underwater. And it turned out that this was... He had decoded the music by reading the neuronal firing patterns of people listening to the music from their auditory cortex. So that kind of blew my mind that was possible. But a lot of the technology got me excited. I mean, it was exciting walking across the quad of MIT with Hugh Herr and not knowing that he didn't have any legs. And it was exciting to learn just about how the human body works, that our legs are composed of this web of complex springs that collect, juggle, and recycle energy. I mean, every time we take a step, we're expending about 50% of the energy from the previous step. And just that it's possible, I never understood why a peg leg would give somebody with amputations back pains or hip pains. Why? And now it's just so obvious with people like Hugh Herr, because, there's nothing there to recycle the energy. There's nothing there to add in new energy. So it's just, I was just continuously overcome with wonder about how the human body and mind work and what we're learning about it and where our limits lie.
Anna Peori, author of The Bodybuilders Inside the Science of the Engineered Human. Here's Dave, who writes, "The improvement of the human mind and body are two incredibly wonderful ideas. To be able to see through hearing, for example, is dramatically life-changing, but with so many great ideas, it takes just one evil idea, put it to motion, that can overshadow anything good. Eugenics comes to my mind, and the concept of being born pure. Has a reporter found engineers that might find eugenics to be for the greater good?
Well, I went to the Beijing Genomics Institute. It's called BGI now because it moved to Shenzhen, and it's this Chinese genomics company. They got about $1 billion loan from the Chinese government, and they have more genetic sequencing power than any place in the planet. They've been involved in, and they have a lot of collaborators in the U.S. and around the world, and they're doing some really interesting things, but they've been involved, one of the things they've been involved with is an effort to reverse engineer intelligence, which a lot of people think is impossible because there's so many genes involved in intelligence. It's such a complex interaction, but it's caused, for obvious reasons, a lot of hand-wringing, you know, for eugenics, also a genetic arms race. So I asked one of the researchers there if he was concerned about it, and he said, well, I think any parent should be able to determine and decide if they want their child to be really intelligent. I said, okay, well, is there anything that alarms you? And he said, well, I could imagine like a really ruthless tiger mom who decides to that she wants her child not only to have superior intelligence, but also to have antisocial sociopathic tendencies that give them zero empathy so they can get ahead in the world. And I thought, wow, that is alarming. So you can imagine any kind of, I mean, who knows? I don't know. We got North Korea, you know, I don't know how ruthless they are if they get these technologies and we're at war. What can I say?
Well, we'll hear what more of our listeners have to say or ask. Let me go to Dale next. Dale, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I wonder if there's any connection between recall one suffers with PTSD, as I do myself, and memory improvement, if one could tap into that effect and use it for positive purposes, if there's any correlation there.
I'm not sure. I mean, people are doing so many things with PTSD and I have read about, you know, it seems like part of the problem with PTSD and memory is that we become hypervigilant, right? And our sympathetic nervous system is overactivated. I've written about this one experiment where they have been taking, they've been using propranolol, which is this beta blocker used for heart disease. And they believe that when you take a memory out, you take it out of storage, and then when you put it back in, it gets what they call reconsolidated. And if you give somebody propranolol while they're remembering the traumatic thing, the memory, it can blunt and somehow neutralize some of that hypervigilance and the brain structures that are hyperactivated in the emotional parts of the brain. That research is very controversial, but people have been looking at that. It definitely seems to be not necessarily the episodic conscious part of the brain, but the parts of the brain where it's the emotional memory that activate our sympathetic nervous system that goes awry with PTSD. And there's people are looking at lots of ways to approach this, but nothing that has emerged as definitely working at this point.
And let me thank you for the call, Dale, and go to some of our emails. We sort of touched on this before, but Ryan wants to know, to what degree will these bioengineered enhancements extend life expectancy of humans?
Well, that's a whole nother issue, and it's also controversial, and there's a lot of people working on it, especially out here. You know, like the caller from Sen said, there's Aubrey de Grey, there's that company I mentioned, with Judy Campisi that's got funding from Jeff Bezos, and there's even some funding from the National Institute of Aging. And then you have Calico. We haven't really pushed it yet. You know, a lot of people, I mean, the length of life expectancy has increased so much just in the last 100 years. If we could do that again, the life expectancy used to be around 40 or something not too long ago, and now we live to be 80 at least, right? So it's not unrealistic to think we could go much longer. The question is, will we be able to improve quality of life, or will we just be decrepit for another 50 years?
That is the basic question.
Yeah, and some people have said that there's not any evidence that we can live past 120. You know, that we might be hitting some sort of biological limit. But we, you know, there's definitely a lot of exciting research going on, and a lot of excitement, especially out here, looking at why we have this systemic failure in our bodies and what we might do about it as we get older. Part of the reason is just evolutionarily, evolution, you know what I mean? Like, we, once we reproduce, there's no natural selective pressure to weed out mutations that make us more likely to die. So after, once we have kids, everything that happens is evolutionarily irrelevant. So it's sort of a systemic collapse.
A couple of quick questions via email, Adam. Elizabeth wants to know, any hope on the horizon for restoring hearing? It is, she writes, a very isolating condition.
Well, it, again, it depends on what the problem is here, you know, where the problem is. Cochlear implants help in some cases, but sometimes hearing loss can be caused by brain damage. You know, sometimes, so yeah, it really just depends on the condition. Yeah, and aging.
What do you know about CRISPR, Tim wants to know? Any thoughts?
Well, CRISPR is, yeah, it's a transformative, remarkable technology that is most people are saying is going to transform what's possible. And it's basically, it allows people to do microsurgery on genes in a much more precise way than was possible before, and much cheaper. And it's already making gene editing much easier. What I found, and I did mention it in my book and talk about it a little bit, but I think the main, and it is, but to me it always, you know, we were always going to develop ways to have more accurate gene editing. The main bottleneck right now is figuring out what genes do what and how they combine with environment.
We're going to have to leave it there. Adam Peery, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Adam's book, again, is The Bodybuilders: Inside the Science of the Engineered Human. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and hours repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. And Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg, and Susan Britton. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Engineer is Howard Gelman. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. And we get online support from Amanda Font. Our interns are Devin Holt and Stephanie Roberts. Managing editor is Ethan Lindsay. Executive producer is Holly Kernan. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.